Og því að kynna speaker kvöldsins, Brian frá Maine, gjörðu svo vel.
Can you even see me over this? Yeah. Sounds like someone from Texas. That's fine. Thank you. Well, I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Brian. And I'm beyond honored to be here. This is wonderful. I'm working on no sleep, so bear with me tonight. And it's amazing to be here. It just really is amazing to be here. I get extremely nervous whenever I'm asked to share my life, and I don't know why, except that it's my life, and I don't know where it's going to go, and I don't know what I'm going to say, except that I've been over there in prayer asking God to give me the words to speak what needs to be said tonight. I've had a wonderful day, and I'm privileged to be here, and I'm honored to be here, but I'm conflicted to be here because I really wasn't supposed to be here. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my good friend Don being sick. And that's not... it's not good, you know, because he would... it's just not good. And so... I don't know if any of you know Don. I've known him for 10 years, and he was part of the change that happened with me. Thank you. And he was paramount in bringing the big book to Maine indirectly through my home group. And so him being ill and being terminally ill is not a good thing. But I got the phone call from Arnar. He called my wife. My wife called me at work and said that some guy from Iceland left a message and she couldn't understand it. And she said, he wants you to speak in Iceland. So, and I'm like, I don't know anyone from Iceland. And then about an hour later, I got a call from Don saying that he would be honored if I could go in his place. And it is an honor to come here. It is an honor to speak anywhere in AA. I never planned on even getting sober. My sobriety date's March 6, 1993, and I didn't wake up that day to get sober. I had kind of resigned to the fact that I was going to kill myself, or I was going to go out and commit some felonies. And for some reason, I woke up that day, and I haven't had a drink since. And that in itself is a miracle. The power of God is amazing. Even when I did not even want that power. I'm blessed beyond belief. And so to be asked to come here and share and to just travel today around your countryside, what a beautiful country you guys have. I mean, you're really blessed to have such a beautiful country. And my wife's, if I'd have known this as being live on the internet, I would call my wife and told her to get online because she's extremely jealous that I'm here. And so I guess we'll have to come back. But, let me just share with you what I was like and what happened, what I'm like now. And I think that's all I really have to offer about, you know, what happened to me and my alcoholism and how it progressed and the hope and the message I found in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous and the change that has transformed me into the man I am today. That day, March 6th of 1993, when I'd gotten up, I was working on a recovery ranch in Arizona. And I'd been in relapse for 3 months. And I don't think that's good when you're trying to tell people how to stay sober and you're drinking in the evening. And that's really what was happening. And it was getting really ugly. I was doing two meetings a day, and then I was drinking after the second meeting. And then saw the old... you probably don't have this phrase here, but we have it in Maine. And it's one of those myths in AA that I think needs to be smashed. And it's meeting makers make it. That's a... big phrase in Maine, and it just kills me when I hear it because I went to two meetings a day and I wasn't making it. You know, I was about ready to kill myself. And so I know there's more to sobriety than just going to meetings, though I need to be in meetings. That in itself is not the solution, never has been the solution. And the reason I drank, see what happened is I was in AA for a year and I didn't do anything. I went to meetings. I was court ordered. I just got out of prison. And so I came to AA because it was either go to go back to prison or go to AA, and I'm not an idiot, you know, so there's women in AA. It just seemed like a good bet to me. And so I went, and but I didn't want to do what they suggested in AA. And then really what the truth was, I just didn't believe I needed to. I never really tried to get sober. I was 30 years old, and I was 29 at that time. And I'd never really tried to get sober. And so I just thought, well, I want to be sober, so I'll just be able to stay sober. And the truth is, for me, I'm a real alcoholic, and without a spiritual solution, I just couldn't do it. And I went to a lot of meetings that year, and about 2 weeks after my year anniversary, I started drinking. And that led me to that day 3 months later. And so let me share you with how that all happened, because I grew up in California. I'm not really from Maine. Maine's just, it's cold. I grew up in Northern California, and then moved down to Tucson, Arizona, and that's where I got sober. And I grew up in a family that, and this isn't why I'm an alcoholic, but it just kind of gives you an idea of where I came from and what my life was like. I come from, my mom's an alcoholic. My mom's a hardcore beer drinker, bar drinker. A lot of drama went on in my family. And to be honest with you, as a young kid, I liked the drama. I liked the action. We had a bar in the back of our house, and I liked the activity that went on, and I liked the energy around that. And I just kind of liked it. And so I started drinking at an early age. I was the youngest of three boys. Well, there was four of us. My other brother died when he was seven. And I liked drinking. Drinking really, I liked the effect it had on me. It made everything going on change. It made me feel okay in my skin. And so I started drinking, 10, 11 years old. And it wasn't like I was a daily drinker. You can't really be a daily drinker when you're that young. But, they would have parties, and I would definitely sneak booze, And I got pictures from when I was a kid. My mom and dad didn't care if I drank. I mean, in fact, the philosophy in my home was, it's okay if you drink, but as long as you don't leave the house, okay, cool with that. And so my alcoholism started progressing slowly, and the behaviors around that were crystal clear. And my pattern for me is, my brother, I'm the youngest, and there's two other ones. One's 4 years older and one's 6 years older. And so I always craved the attention of my older brother. And when I was like 10, 11, if he would say, if you steal a bike at school today, I'll give you $5. And so I would steal a bike and get $5 and also get the recognition from his peers, like, oh, your little brother's crazy, And then I'd see that they liked me because of that, and so then I would do. So I would do, and that pattern would go all the way up until I got sober. And that if I did something that you approved of, and I got your kindness and your acceptance, then I would do that, no matter what it was, no matter what morals I was breaking, it didn't matter. And I just ran with that. And my alcoholism really didn't. I didn't become a daily drinker until I was 18. When I was 14, I moved to Tucson. And I did that one thing where I was going to get new friends, I'm 14 years old, I need new friends. I think that's a sign that you maybe have a problem if at 14 you need to start over. But, so I'm like, okay, I'll get new friends, moving to Tucson. And I went to Tucson, I started looking for new friends. Well, the people that weren't drinking and drugging, dude, nothing was happening there, man. I got to be honest with you, it was boring. And that lasted about a month, I'm like, this is lame. And so I found the guys who were drinking and drugging, the guys who were leaving high school, going across the street to go smoke their weed and drink on the weekends. Those are the guys I started hanging out with. And I had a knack of drinking with guys who drank a little bit more than me and who were a little bit crazier than me, so I could always look at them, and they were like my measuring stick. If I ever get like Norman, then I'll stop drinking. Norman was like this 6'2" guy who fought all the time. I'm like, I'm not going to fight anybody. Come on. I'm like doing my best to avoid fights. So I never got like Norman. I was never a violent drunk, and at 18 years, I graduated in 1980. I'm 42 years old, and I barely graduated in high school, and I did this thing where I made this decision not to go to college. I'm not going to go to university. I'm just going to go move in with a bunch of buddies of mine, and I'll take a year off. And that was 25 years ago. still waiting to come back with that one. But, it was a good plan. In my mind, I thought it made sense. I've been in school for 12 years. I need a break. And moved in with a bunch of buddies. Four guys living in a house. We're all 18 years old. And we're all construction workers. And we're all just became daily drinkers. And that was when everything started to progress for me. 18 to 21 was a blur. The drama, I always get a little bit worried about sharing my story because some stuff happened in my story that, people, if you're new and you say, well, I never did that, so I'm not an alcoholic. That's not, the story I'm about to tell you is not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because when I put alcohol into my body, I can't control the amount I drink. Something happens, and I have a mind that tells me it'll be different every time. That's what makes me alcoholic. The drama that I'm about to share with you is just a, you know, it's a symptom of what happens, and not everyone gets that. And to me, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that's what happened to me. I have no problem with all the time I spent in prison. I'm totally okay with that because it got me to a place where I'm at peace with myself. And so from 18 to 21, I just was daily drinking. And it wasn't a lot of, you know, we had a lot of fun. I got to tell you, I had a lot of fun in my early drinking. It wasn't all drama, you know. I mean, I had a girlfriend. I had a job. We'd go to road trips to Mexico. We'd go to Las Vegas. We'd go skiing. Sometimes I wouldn't pay rent for 2 months, but, you know, we can make that up. And started doing drugs, started doing cocaine, and that became a problem when you're making $7 an hour and you start getting a habit like I got. So you get a little creative. My creativity was I would deal drugs. That was a good one. I said, well, I can be the local dealer. And but if you're using more than you're selling, that's a problem. And so financially, I ended up digging this hole. And so by the time I was 21, I was in this huge financial debt all around Tucson. And I'd pretty much burned all my bridges, and I was drinking daily, and I wasn't telling anybody about this. I was keeping it a secret. I was taking rent money from my roommates, and I was paying, you know, I was just shuffling money all over the place, and it was getting really crazy. And I'm going to share this story. I don't really share this too much, but I'll share this story just because it kind of just gives you an idea of what I'm not. There's a buddy of mine, we're sitting around, this guy named Dave, and Dave's no longer with us. Dave killed himself about 3 years into my prison sentence. He put a gun in his mouth, and he was one of us. He was a candidate for the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dave and I were sitting around, and we were drunk, and we were both crying that we didn't have any money. And I came up with this idea. I said, well, Dave, we can go rob the Kentucky Fried Chicken. I don't know if they have them here, but it's a really quality chicken place. And so I made this plan. We're going to go rob this Kentucky Fried Chicken, and my roommates were gone, so I took my roommate's car, and we took his gun and ski mask and rope, and we had this great plan to go do this. And it was, I mean, we were really, like, pumped to do this. I mean, we're 21-year-old kids, never really committed any crime. We're, like, we're jamming AC/DC on the way over to this place, you know, like, yeah, you know. And so we get there, and we pull in, and we're, like, pumping each other up, and we go into this place, and we walk into the door, and, you know, it's like, it's very surreal today, but everyone's like, it got real quiet when we walked in. Nick, people behind the counter kind of looked at us, and then I told Dave, I said, I go to the bathroom. So we both went to the bathroom, and he goes, what's up? And I said, dude, I can't do this. He goes, yeah, me neither. And he goes, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I don't know, let's go eat. So we went and had like a two-piece meal, and so it describes that I'm not really a gangster. But I was still hopeless. You know, I'm a 21-year-old kid, and I'm hopeless. And I drop Dave off. You know, we eat our meal, and I drop him off, and I go home. And I'm really extremely intoxicated now. And I made this decision. And the more I'm around, the longer I know there's lots of people who've made this decision. And some have followed through, and some haven't. But I made the decision just to kill myself. And it wasn't a cry for help. I'm going to cut my wrists and then go in my roommate's room. And, you know, that wasn't what I was looking for. It was like, I'm done. And so, again, I took my roommate's car. Because I'm thinking, if you're going to kill yourself, definitely don't want to kill yourself in your car. And I drive all the way out in the desert, and I'm pumping fumes into my car. And I can still today smell it. Whenever I smell car fumes, I can still almost get back to that place of sitting in the car, and the fumes are coming in, and I'm sitting there, and I'm crying, and I'm writing notes, you know, to my girlfriend. I'm writing notes to my friends, and I'm... And I get to this note to my mother, and my mother had already buried a boy. You know, she already buried her son from leukemia. And as I'm writing this note, I couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't do that to my mom. And it was probably the only selfless thought I ever had up until that time, that I just couldn't do that. What it would do to my mom to find her baby in a car, and the will to live was a little bit stronger than the will to die. And so I stumbled out of the car and walked around the desert for the rest of the night and realized that this is what I realized, that my problem was lack of money. Lack of money is my problem. And if that's your problem, there's only one solution for that: money. And so I took my roommate's car and drove into town, and I drove up to this bank, and I walked in and I robbed it. And I say it, as a matter of fact, like that because that's how it felt. I walked in, handed the teller a note, said, I have a gun. Well, this is what it said. This is another description, so you know I'm really not a gangster. And I never told this for a long time, and my wife made me say it when I started to get asked to speak. She says, you never really get honest about what happened that day. I'm like, well, the details are bogus. You know, it says share in a general way. I don't need to get specific. She goes, yeah, you just say it because you just don't want your ego smashed. And so the truth is, here's the way it went down. My first bank robbery, I got $50. Kidding. I'm glad it amuses you. And the reason I got $50 is because I wrote, I have a gun, give me $50 or I will shoot you. And she hit. It pains me to tell that story. It's just like, and I know if any of the guys I ever did time with ever hear this, they're going to go like, that little guy lied the whole time. Because anytime anybody asked me why I was doing time, like, oh, I got $70,000. And really what happened is, this is the way it probably looked for her. Is I was kind of looking up at the, shoving a little note up there. Say, hey, give me my $50. And she should have just reached over and slapped me and told me to go home. Because I was like 21 years old. I was probably 5'1". Well, I've been 5'1" since ninth grade. But, you know, it was acne all over, blonde hair. I just was a mess. So I got my $50 and I ran out. And I get to my car and I'm excited. I'm like, yeah. No, I didn't say $50 until I looked at it. I'm like, oh. Drove over to this convenience store, bought some Budweiser, and drank about 3 or 4 beers and kind of calmed the nerves down. And drove all the way across town and robbed another bank. And I got the money I needed that time. I didn't ask for $50 that time. And then I went to work the next day. You know, I mean, the insanity of my life is I went and paid all my bills, paid all my dealers, paid the rent, paid everything, got everything caught up, went home, had some extra money in my pocket, took my girlfriend out to dinner, and then got up and went to work the next day. Like nothing happened. You know? Like, okay, one day you're just a goofball, now you're a bank robber. I mean, and became a daily drinker and started running the game one more time and kept that lie up for a long time. 6 months later, I'm painting houses, you know, working for this guy, and I'm running out of money again. So I say, hey, can I use your truck? You know, I got to go down to town. And he gives me the keys to his van, and I drive into town, rob a bank, come back to the job site an hour later. Hey, what's up, you know? That kind of angered the FBI. They frown on that. Here's what happened, and then we'll get to some real good recovery. But here's what happened is I came home from work. This is about 2 weeks later, and I'm feeling good. You know, I got all my money, got my debts paid off. I'm like, all right, this is cool. Anytime I need money, I'll just go rob a bank. Nobody knows me. It's a million people in Tucson. How are they going to know me, you know? So I come home from work, and I go to the refrigerator like I always do to get some beer, and there's a picture of me from the local paper, and it's not my name, but it says, you know, definitely a picture of me. I mean, you have to be blind not to notice that that's me. And it says 8-8 crime. This gentleman's wanted for 3 bank robberies. If you know anything, it's a $5,000 reward. And my roommates cut it out of the painting, you know, cut it out of the paper and put it on the refrigerator. And so I go to the refrigerator. As soon as I see that, you know, my knees get weak. And I'm like, oh, my God. And then because I'm a good alcoholic, I recover real quick and snatch it off. And I walk in the room, and they're all sitting around smoking weed and just hanging out in oblivion. And I throw it on the table, and I go, what's that? And these guys, no lie, these guys I live with, they all three look at me and they go, dude, you're not going to believe it. There's some guy looks just like you. Rob Banks. And I'm like, cool, you know. Yeah, that's crazy, you know. And then so anybody came over that day, we'd show them the picture, you know. And about 2 weeks later, I got arrested. You know, 2 weeks later, the FBI knocked on my door, and we used to make jokes when I was doing time of guys like, oh, you didn't get arrested, you got saved, you know, and the reality is I was saved because I was heading down a track that was not good, and I opened the door and there's 3 guys in suits and they asked me my name, you know, are you Brian Percox? And I said, yeah, and they said, we have a warrant for your arrest, and I got arrested and went to prison that day, and You know, my life changed. It changed, but it didn't change. You know, it changed in the fact that the game was over for a minute. But as soon as three days later, my parents bailed me out and got me a lawyer. And I told them this lie. And, and all my friends are impressed. But, it's just not good. And so I'm about ready to go to trial for these bank robberies. And I'm talking to my lawyer, and my lawyer says, Brian, you're guilty. I've seen the evidence. You're gonna go to prison. You can't rob three banks and not go to prison. And I had lived in this delusion that I'm just a young kid. I'm not a criminal. I've had some bad luck. I got a problem. And he's like, it doesn't matter. It's a matter of how much time you're gonna do now. And when you put that kind of stuff in my mind, I just was drinking to oblivion. I think I was drinking to die. I was getting up early, drinking all day, and it was just getting crazy. And 2 weeks before I went to trial, on a Friday afternoon, I robbed another bank. And, now, that's a description of an idiot. Because I can tell you right now, there was no other 5'1" bank robbers going to trial that year. It was not happening. And my mind said, well, I'll just get away. I'll do it different. I'll put a disguise. I don't know what I was thinking. But I know in subconsciously I was thinking, well, I'll do it on Friday. I'll at least get the whole weekend to party. And so I did this party that was just unbelievable. And Monday they came and got me, and I wasn't to get out for the next 6 years. And my 6 years in prison, I did absolutely nothing to better my life. I didn't address my alcoholism. I didn't address my addiction to cocaine. I didn't address anything. All I did was play the game. I learned... And I would honestly say, for me, when you're 5'1" and you're 110 pounds and you go to a prison, a federal prison in the States, and there's 1,700 inmates and 1,000 of them are black from the inner city, you start to adapt certain ways to survive. And I just watched, how to survive. And it definitely wasn't going to counseling. And it definitely wasn't getting sober. And it was... basically living like a convict. And the scary part is I really adapted quickly to that lifestyle. I became, I'm not proud of this, but I became a racist in prison. Never believed it for a minute, except that the people around me almost required that I believe it. And so I would spout stuff off that I didn't believe. I started using heroin in prison. It just became, the things I would never do, I started to become. I started to really just strip every moral fiber from my body. And I got out. I got out 5 years, 8 months later. And here's the truth and the reality of my family, and I know this today, is my family stuck by me. My friends, none of them ever came visit me. None of them hardly even accepted phone calls from me. But my mom and dad would come out to Detroit and visit me. Indiana, when I was in Indiana, they would spend time. And you know what the truth is? And this is a really hard... when I went through the steps, this one really rocked my world, that my mom and dad did every single day I did in the penitentiary. I took my family with me to the penitentiary because my mom didn't know if I was going to live or die. And all I could ever think about is, I'm the one doing time. Give me this, give me that. And as I started to do my inventory, when I went through this four-step, I had this huge resentment against my mom. I had this huge awakening around that fact that, that my mom had to do time with me. That when I got out of prison, she'd aged 20 years. And what kind of son does that to his? What kind of son does that to his mom? I got out 5 years, 8 months later, and my family, my mom and dad, brought me right back home. And my dad got me a job, and he got me a car, and he gave me a credit card. That's a mistake. And I was drinking the day I got out. I was drinking on the plane ride from Indianapolis, because I ended up going to Terre Haute, Indiana, where I ended up finishing up. And on the plane ride home, I was drinking, And the lie I told myself, and this is what the steps told me, was, oh, I'm just a cocaine addict. I'm not alcoholic. I got a drug problem. That's obvious. I mean, I wasn't robbing banks to support my alcohol problem, that's for sure. And so I wanted to focus on that. I don't want to focus on that. I can't drink safely, that I'm not supposed to be drinking, and if I drink, I'll go back to prison, and yet I have to drink. I could not even fathom of not drinking. So that wasn't what I was thinking. And so the reality was, I'm drinking on the way home, drinking as soon as I get there, going to counseling, lying to my spot, lying to everybody, my parole officer. 8 months later, violation, 3 dirty urines, go back to prison. Go back in front of the same judge, sends me right back to prison, And this is when things changed for me, because up until that time, my family was back in my pocket. You know, I could do what I wanted. And my mom wrote me a letter. I was back maybe 3 days, and my mom wrote me this letter. And the letter was clear cut. It said, "Dear Brian," I'm going to paraphrase it because it's a lot longer than what I'm going to say. She says, "Dear Brian, we love you too much to watch you die in our house. I've already buried one son. I do not want to witness the burying of another son. So you're not welcome here anymore. I love you too much. When you get out, you can't come home." And the harsh reality of that is I made my mom write that letter. And the lie I told myself was, my mom, how dare my mom disown me? And coming out the other end through my inventory, the truth was I put the pen in my mom's hand and I made her write that to her baby boy. I made her disown. And she often tells me today that it was harder to do that than it was to bury Chucky. She says, because when Chucky died, I had no choice. There's no choice on that. Leukemia took him. I had nothing. I couldn't do anything about that. But with you, everything, every fiber of my body screamed not to do that. Not every fiber of my motherhood screamed not to disown you, not to walk away from my child. And, but she had to. And, you know, I've told that story hundreds of times. I can't ever say it without, you know, getting emotional because, you know, I was talking on the way over here. I got a 3-year-old daughter, and I can't imagine. I just can't imagine having to do that. I can't imagine that. And, I mean, the good news is my family's back, and you know, I didn't tell my mom I was coming to Iceland to speak, but my wife did. And my mom's very proud of me today. You know, the healing process of the steps is amazing. But everything that she said in that letter came true, because when I got out a year later, I was a 28-year-old young man, and I had no money. I had no job. I had the clothes on my back. I had nothing. And I had to go live in a halfway house in downtown Tucson. I had nothing. My first 2 weeks out, I had to go sell plasma just for bus money. And I remember vividly standing in line. You know, first I remember seeing the ad in the paper, thinking that I was, you know, I'm being an entrepreneur because I'm going to go sell my blood, you know. And I remember standing in line with all the other winners that were selling their blood that day. And see, the ego that I have, the arrogance inside of me, I'm looking at everybody else thinking, what a bunch of losers. Like, I'm a winner. And I just got out of prison. You know, I pretty much spent from 22 to 29 in prison, and I'm thinking, losers. I heard a guy say this. I can't take credit for it, but it's the best thing I ever heard on ego. And when he said it, I thought, oh, yeah, that's me. It was at an AA meeting. It was my first month in AA, and I actually asked him to be my sponsor after he said this. I'll tell you how sick I am. But he said, they're asking about ego, and talking about ego, and it came to him, and he said, "Ah, ego." He says, "I don't know. My ego would kill a lesser man." You have to think about that—the arrogance of that statement—and I just didn't get it. You know, I just didn't get it. I didn't know how to live, and so I ended up at this halfway house, and I ended up—I was out 3 days, and I started drinking again. I couldn't, and they told me, if you drink while you're here, we're going to send you back to prison. And I'm going to tell you, the most important thing to me at that time was my freedom. And yet, I had to have a drink. I could not. I was supposed to go out and look for a job. As soon as I got outside the premises, everything in my body screamed, I need something to knock the edge off. And so I went and bought a bottle. And I get away with it because I'm slick for a little bit. And so I drink till noon, and then I white-knuckle it and come back. And I did that the next day, and then the third day, my body said, no, that ain't happening. You ain't coming back to the halfway house without booze this time. Because the first two nights, I wanted to scream just to have more booze, you know, because my body was aching for it. And so I snuck some tequila on and got drunk that night, and surprised, I got caught, you know. And that's when I got sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, my parole officer, Tim, I'll never forget, I hated this guy with a passion, and he came and visited me. That was on a Friday night I got caught. He came and visited me on Monday, and I thought I was going back. thought I was going back for sure. And he, in fact, when they called my name on the loudspeaker, you know, Brian to the office, I had my little bag of whatever, you know, I think I had shampoo and some toothpaste. I brought it with me. And he says, "What's in the bag?" And I said, "Well, I want to have toothpaste and some shampoo when I go back to prison." He says, "You know, sit down. Let me talk to you." And which was a surprise. He had just violated me. He's the one who sent me back for the year before. And so he sat me down and he said, and he did something for me which was not even justified. I didn't even merit it. But he gave me an opportunity that has changed my life. He said, "I want to share something with you." He says, "I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years." He says, "And you keep thinking that you're a drug addict, and you're an alcoholic." He says, "You can't even stay sober a week after going back for a year." He says, "You got a serious problem with booze." He says, "I'm going to do you a favor, and it's the last favor I'm going to do you." He says, "But I'm going to recommend to the parole commission that you not go back to prison, but you have to go to AA every day while you're here. You got to get your sheet signed, and for the next 4 months, you have to go to an AA meeting. If you miss one meeting or you get one write-up while you're here, I'm going to send you back to prison." He says, "So what do you want to do?" "Okay, I'll go to AA." And AA, I'm going to tell you right now, AA scared me to death. The whole idea of getting sober scared me because I didn't know how to live sober. And then going into the meetings, so I went to the Alano Club, Northwest Alano Club, and it was like 110 out. And I drink, of course, I'm a newcomer, so I drink about 14 cups of coffee. And so like coffee's pouring out of me. And people are trying to talk to you, you know, like the gauntlet that I had to walk through here, you know, that would have frightened me. You know, it would have been like, I was a shoe watcher at that time. You know, I was like watching shoes, couldn't look people in the eye. And so guys would come up to me like, "Hey, how are you?" You know, and they'd shake my hand. "Welcome." They knew I was a newcomer. I don't know how, but they did. And they say, you know, "Welcome to the meeting." And the stupidest thing they ever said was, "Well, come back tomorrow." And I'm like, "I got to get my sheet signed. I got to come back. You know, like I have a choice, you know." And but they knew I got my sheet signed, and they knew that I was from New Beginnings Treatment Center, and they knew that, and yet they still gave me lots of love and kindness. And I used to take the bus. I'd be at the bus stop, and it would be, you know, it'd be literally 110 out, and the desert gets really hot, and it'd be coming down on me, coffee's pouring out of me, and the guy would drive up in his Cadillac. I never forget this. Guy drove up in his Cadillac, and it's like icicles are inside his car from the air conditioning, you know. He's like, it's like a frost in there. And he'd roll his window down and be like, he said, "Hey, you want to ride back to the halfway house?" And I'm like, "No, I'm cool." "Yeah, I got this. Don't worry about that." Because, you know, and the truth was, I was a 29-year-old man, and I had never experienced unconditional love. I'd never experienced any, you know, that I put myself in and that I'd lived in for a long time was a world of take and hate. And I always took kindness for weakness. And if you were kind, you were trying to get something. I knew that from the first day I was in prison. As soon as guys come up and said, "Hey, you want some coffee?" I knew what he wanted. "He wanted to give me coffee? I'm a good-looking kid, you know?" So I carried that in the AA. It's an old idea that if you're kind and loving to me, you want something from me. That's an old idea, and I had to get smashed. And it got smashed in the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous because they didn't want anything from me. The only thing they wanted from me was for me to see the hope and what the opportunity was that I could live a different life. That's all, you know. I often say, you know, I'm sober by the grace of God. It used to bother me. I used to hear that all the time, that grace of God. What, the guy who died today didn't have that grace, you know? And because that's what I thought, you know, because that's what it sounds like. If I'm sober by the grace of God, then I know someone's dying of alcoholism tonight, so he didn't have it, right? And I heard this speaker say, and he said, "It's not what it means. It means that I'm sober by the grace of God because I accept God's grace." And that's the reality of my sobriety, is that once I accepted God's grace, the doors opened, you know? And I didn't accept God's grace my first time in AA. That first year that my parole officer sent me there, I got off parole. I lasted about a year, and I drank again, and then I came back. What happened is I got off all the paper, and then I drank again because there was nothing tied to me anymore, right? Drank, and then that March 6th day when I woke up. And here's what happened after that, because this is what's important, and this is the message I really believe that we need to carry. And it's obviously the message that you guys are carrying here because you guys are amazing. I mean, this is, for me, it's like, when I got sober in Maine, we were all young. We were all just a bunch of vibrant young people. You know, energy was like, "Yeah, and the answer's in the book, and do it," you know. And all the old-timers hated us. And everybody, you know, were like, "Whoa, wait." You know, but we're the ones who put conferences on. We're the ones who got things going. And And there's a guy out in Arizona who had that. He was 27 years old, and he'd been sober 7 years. So he got sober when he was 20. And everybody around Kenny was getting better. And I didn't like Kenny my first year in AA because he talked about God. He talked about making amends. We don't want to do that. Not when you're a thief like me. When you've robbed from every place you work, you don't want to make amends. I mean, come on. We skip that step. Jump right over to 10, right? He talked about doing, you know, being responsible for our recovery. He talked about stuff that, you know, and I was hanging around people who, I'd say, Kenny's a little too serious, don't you think? You know, I mean, but you know what? All my buddies, all my little clique end up drinking again. And, you know, when I came back, none of the guys I ran with were around anymore. But everybody that Kenny was hooked up with, they're all getting better. And so I went and asked Kenny to sponsor me. I said, I need help. He says, yeah, I know that. And I said, I always paint him to be a harder guy than he is. He really is a loving man. But he was honest and brutally honest with me. And I said, I need some help. And I told him what had happened. He said, that doesn't surprise me. And I said, will you sponsor me? And he says, you know, it'd be a privilege and an honor to sponsor you. Which kind of blew me away. Kind of made me feel like, yeah, I guess it would be. Because I'm something special, you know. And so he says, do you have a big book? And I said, no. So he gave me a big book. And he says, I want you to read the doctor's opinion, and I'll come up and see you on Thursday. And this was like a Sunday. And he came up and sat down, and he explained to me in about 2 hours more about alcoholism, about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had even been open to my first year. I mean, he laid out the truth. He told me the flat-out truth. He said, okay, here's the solution. Just so you know, let's cut to the chase. It's a spiritual solution. Don't let anyone tell you. If anyone's telling you anything different, get away from them, all right? Because they're lying. This is a spiritual solution. There is not 20 different AA programs. There's one program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They put it in the big book, and they said, here, this is what we did. If you want what we have, do what we do. And he was very loving. He says, now, you can either do that and get sober with me, or you can do what you did the first year. You know. And you know, the reality was, I was open to God's grace, because God's grace was right there. That was God's grace for me, right there. Here's a man. I asked him. He presented a solution, a real solution. And he said, if you want it, it's here for the taking. And he started to explain about alcoholism. I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. He said, are you alcoholic? I said, yeah. He says, well, why? That was a... I don't know, because everybody in the room says it. And so I don't want to be different, so when it comes around to me, I'm an alcoholic. I had no idea what it meant to be alcoholic. So he talked to me about the allergy. He talked about the obsession of the mind. He started explaining things on why it made sense. And when I went to bars, or when I started drinking, and when I was only going to have one or two, and I'd end up drinking to a blackout, he started explaining why that happened. Never heard about that before. Wasn't being said in some of the meetings I was going to. Made sense to me. He explained the first step. Says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and then it has a dash, and it says, our lives are unmanageable. I thought it meant, my life's unmanageable because I'm an alcoholic. He says, no, no, no. He says, when you read that sentence in English, he says, it's, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, so that you admit that, and then a hyphen, our lives are unmanageable, goes back to the front of the sentence, which means you admit that your life's unmanageable. So I'm like, you know, so we talked about the unmanageability, and I really thought my life was manageable. He said, well, let's just take a look at what kind of job you've been doing, you know. And as soon as he said it, I'm like, oh, this is not going to be good, you know. Like, my life was a failure. It was crystal clear to me. And so I admitted that, you know, and we started to get into the second step. And here's the reality of who I was when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I believe 100% in the power of God today. I've been talking to God for the last 12 years. I just celebrated 12 years about a week ago. And there's no question. And I can't take credit for it. The only I would love to. There were been times when I thought, well, I did the inventory. And then my sponsor would say, really? Well, let's talk about that. And I'm like, whenever he said that, I knew there was something going on. But I didn't like God. I had real issues with God. And a lot of it was old ideas, you know, like my brother died, Chucky died when he was 7. I was 5, he was 7. What kind of God would kill my brother? That was a lie, had to be smashed. He said, well, why do you assume God killed your brother? I'm like, I don't know. He says, that sounds like an old idea. Maybe I'll look at that. I had to really look at that. That's a thought. No one even told me that. My mom didn't come in my room and say, well, God killed Chucky. You know, that was never said to me. That was something I invented in my mind. You know, I invented that. And I had to look at that. And the reality is, when I was in prison, there's this guy, I'll never forget him, he was Christian Joe. And I used to play chess with Christian Joe. He was one of those born-agains, and I had no problem with born-agains, but at the time I did. And he was one of those guys in my cell block. I lived in cell block C in Terre Haute, Indiana. I'll never forget, it was like the dirty, grungy, and I was one of those guys who, since I had fear about, you know, looking good, I never bathed. I'd bathe like maybe twice a week, only if I had to. And I'd try to grow this funky-ass, you know, funky, I don't even know what it was, spotty beard. I couldn't even grow a beard, but so I just looked like a rangy little creepy kid, you know. That's what I looked like. And I was pretty ugly at the time. I was just like, I was a dirty little guy, basically, you know. My wife has pictures because they have these things you can take pictures. I want to take pictures of the guys I was hanging out with in prison. My wife's like, man, is that you? You know, I just wasn't, you know. And a lot of guys were like that. And yet Joe would wear these khakis and he was all like his hair cut and he was shaved every day and he was real. And he always carried his Bible and he was like peaceful. And I was just the complete opposite. And I would torment Joe. I'd play chess with him and then I would talk trash. I was the only trash-talking chess player, you know. And he would always look at me and he'd say, you know, Brian, I'm praying for you. And I'm like, save your breath, Joe. And so now I'm coming in AA and my sponsor's telling me that the solution is spiritual. And I'm going to tell you, when you've been pushing God away for your whole life, and now that's the solution. If I hadn't done a thorough first step and really felt the powerlessness, in fact, I know a guy, when you really know you're powerless, when you really feel it internally, I had this immense amount of fear just rip through my gut that like, oh my gosh, if I'm hopeless, unless there better be a God. And when you've been pushing that away, so he's talking to me. He had me read We Agnostics. That's my favorite chapter in the big book because it really got rid of a lot of my old ideas around God. And he taught me how to pray. He taught me about, basically, was I willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself, which I said I was. And he let me form my own relationship. And since that day, I have not stopped talking to God. I can honestly say there has not been a day that does not go by that I don't hit my knees and ask God, you know, for his will to be in my life. It's as simple as that. And that has changed my life because that pushed me into this place where I was able to do a third step with him and make this decision to turn my will in my life, you know, and my will in my life, basically my, you know, my thoughts and my actions. And I started to do this inventory process and, you know, I do it probably like everybody else. You know, we do the four step out of the big book. We do four columns. We do fear inventory, sex inventory. And my awakening started after my fifth step. You know, up until that time, I was about 3 months sober when I finished my inventory. And that's about how long I think it takes to do one at the most, you know, really. But some guys take a year because they want to, you know, try their will for a while. But I wrote, and I remember going to his place, and I was still in rehab at the time, and reading on this inventory, and then sharing these, like, deep secrets that I was going to the grave with, you know, and feeling this immense freedom. And after I did all three of them, part of that four step, he brought me back and he gave me the directions to go up. And I went up to the top of this mountain, this desert, and there's just like a prayer stone up here. And it was sunset, and I'd been praying to God for the last 3 months, but I hadn't really felt the presence of God. I just was doing it kind of to do it, and because I knew that was the solution, but I just never really felt that. And I didn't know really what it felt like, but I just did it. And there was times I thought, this is bogus, you know, but I kept doing it. And after I did that four step, after I finished that fifth step, I went up there. And I remember to this day, this overwhelming feeling deep inside of me of peace, which I had never felt before, walking down that mountain after about an hour, realizing that my life had changed. And if I continued to live this life, it would only get better. And that the obsession to drink was removed at that time from me. I no longer felt the desire to drink, and it has never returned. And the few times that it has popped into my mind is just as it promises in the 10th step. It's like a hot flame, man, just in and out. And any time that a thought of drink came before, it would fester in my mind, and I would try to think it out of my mind, and then I would succumb to the desire, and I would drink again. And now it's just like it's promised. I think about it. You know, I haven't thought about a drink in a long time, but the early first 3-4 years, the thought would come, and it would be like, boom, right out. Like, that's insane. And that's the promise. That's the solution. That's where you move from being like suffering from alcoholism to being a recovered alcoholic. You know, that's what my sponsor promised me. And he did the best thing he ever did was he said, he picked me up, I was 6 months sober, and he says, we're going to a meeting. And I wasn't speaking at meetings. I was scared to speak at meetings. I was scared to speak tonight. You know, I have immense fear about speaking publicly. And so he's like taking me to this meeting. I go, where are we going? He says, oh, we're going to the youth detention center. I said, oh, that'd be cool. He says, yeah, it'd be really cool because you're speaking. And I'm like, whoa. He says, dude, these guys, they're all 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. You can't kill them. Just go there and share your story. Like, maybe one of them will see that they don't have to live like you. And I went there. And I'm going to tell you right now, that act alone saved my life. Because that changed everything I thought about service work, about being of service, carrying this mission. Because what happened is, I walked in. I didn't know what I was going to say. I tell him, I said, I'm nervous. I don't know what to say. He says, well, you shouldn't be thinking about anything you're going to say. Just pray. And so I asked God to put words in my mouth. And I spoke for an hour. And I had no idea what I said. I just know the feeling that these young men had about my desire to be of service to them and how happy they were. And more importantly, as I was walking out, I felt this unbelievable sensation of like, man, that's the deal. Like, we got to carry this message. Like, people need that. This is there. There's a solution. And I have not stopped from that moment on. And I met my wife. I don't like to say this publicly, but I met her in rehab. And We celebrated 10 years of marriage. So, but if you're in rehab and you're looking for, it was, we had already done fourth and fifth steps. We were in recovery. Both had good big book sponsors, and we were in the process. You know, and we were moving forward. And so she wanted to move back to Maine. We're in Arizona, and so a year sober, we ended up moving to Maine. And I moved to Maine. You know, it's like for me, it was like, hey, I turn my life over to God. Whatever God has in store for me, I'm just game. And my wife wanted to move, and her mom lived there. She was lonely for her mom, and her dad and her sister, and I said, okay, let's go. We had a job offer and a place to stay, and I moved to Maine. I had nothing else going on except we had the idea that we were going to start the best AA meeting in Maine. And we went to this district, and we went to this, what they call districts, you know, it's like our district. It's, you know, probably like 30 meetings. It's very rural where I'm from. You know, my hometown has 2,200 people, so that's where, but they're all real close to each other, so there's a bunch of them. And the first thing that was painfully clear to me was that there was no big book meeting out of 33 meetings a week. And that was not okay. And I remember calling my sponsor a lot that month. Like, this is crazy. They don't want to hear about the big book. They hate me. Blah, 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 blah. And he's like, well, maybe you should start your own meeting. You know? And so we started the big book meeting. We started actually meeting in our house. Listening to Joe and Charlie tapes is what we started. I mean, that was really, we were like a year, 2 years sober, and nobody really wanted to hear what we had to say, but they'd listen to these guys who had 30 years. So we'd put the tapes on and trick them into getting the message that way. And then like, wow, I never heard that. And it's like, oh, I've heard of that. Oh, really? Yeah, you want to learn how to do that? You know? And so we started to sponsor people, and then we started this meeting. And we just started doing what you guys are doing. We just started doing what lots of people do, these pockets of enthusiasm where they just want to carry a message. And we started to get sober, and people started getting well. And people, God put people in my life, you know, and I haven't had, you know, I don't think I've had less than 10, 15 sponsors ever since my first year of sobriety at some time, either currently or in the process or whatever. It's just the way God puts people in my path, you know, because I know at my core problem is I'm a selfish alcoholic. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that is the root of my problem. If that's the root of my problem, that is my problem. So anything I can do to not be selfish and self-centered. And my sponsor said, well, what's the opposite of selfish? Selfless. What's the opposite of self-centered? God-centered. We'll try to achieve that ideal. And so I spend all my energy trying to be of service to other people. You know, constant thought of others. I mean, the whole book is riveted. It's just, that's all it says. You can't read anything else. Be of service. Help people. Get out of yourself. This isn't about me anymore. And I was sitting in Maine, and I'm sitting there thinking, okay, why am I in Maine? You ever get those like, okay, what's the big picture here? You know, I'm 3 or 4 years sober, and I'm looking for some, actually I did have an epiphany, but I was looking for some big white light. Like, why am I in Maine? And I'm sitting on my deck, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, okay, why am I in Maine? And all of a sudden it hit me like that. Like, oh my God, I'm within about 20 miles of 5 to 6 penal institutions. Like, I'm right smack in the middle, and I'm active in every single one of those. There's only 2 other ones in the state of Maine, and they're like, so out of 7, I'm right within 20 miles of 5. And I believe God has a purpose for us. And I remember it brought me all the way back to this time when I was about 9 months sober and I was complaining to my sponsor about all my time in prison and I'm never going to be able to get my 20s back, you know, and I'm so far behind, I'm behind everybody. And I was in that whining stage, you know. And I remember I was whining like that, like, and he's like, okay, pulled over. And he said, look, let me just share something with you. With that attitude, those 7 years you spent in prison would be a waste. But maybe it's God's plan for you to be of service to those people that are locked up. He says, I don't know, call me crazy, but maybe that's what God has in store. And I remember having that epiphany and calling him up and saying, I know exactly what you're talking about, Ken. And so I go to more meetings in the prison than I'd go anywhere else, you know, because I got a 3-year-old daughter and I got a job that allows me to have a lot of flexibility. And I sponsored probably, more guys in prison than outside of prison, almost 50-50. And not just like call me up and talk about their problems, but talk about going through the steps out of the big book and getting free while they're locked up. Because freedom has nothing to do with the walls. Shoot, I was locked up way before I went to prison. And I was locked up when I got out of prison. I've been in my own jail. And alcoholics, if you're not a real alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. And I've always been in jail, you know. And so my job is to carry a message of hope. And to sit with these guys and take them through this process and allow them the gift to be free. Start making amends, rebuild relationships, start to build their families back, get with their kids. I got a guy right now that's probably going to take custody of his kid while he's locked up. Well, that's amazing. You know, and that's the power of the healing. And the amends process, which allowed me the dignity to go back to my family and sit down with my mom and share with her how wrong I was, that I made her disown me, that it wasn't her fault. You know, that she did nothing wrong, that I did that to her. And I would do anything to make it right. And I will do anything to make it right. I'll be the best son you ever had. And so all she says, I just want you to be happy. And so I'm happy. I never call my mom when I'm sad. I'm always happy. And now the healing process of that, going back to the people that I stole from. And the true awakening and the spirit that flows through us is amazing. And I am eternally grateful that I was open to God's grace just long enough to go through this process and be awakened and know that I have to continue to do this. I have to continue to let God flow through me, outside of me, to be of service to others. That's what we have here. That's the power. And I don't think I could ever repay it. I couldn't sponsor enough guys. I couldn't spend enough energy in Alcoholics Anonymous to ever repay the freedom I got here, you know, that I'm finally becoming the man that I always wanted to be. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I thank you for allowing me to come here and share. Thank you.